Hi, everyone. Welcome to Mold Talks. I'm your host, Michael Rubino, and today's special guest is Andy from Green Design Center. I'm really excited to have this conversation. Been speaking with Andy for a few minutes offline, getting to know him and his and what he does for folks. And I'm really blown away. And I think that you guys will be too after kind of listening to this episode. Andy, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking the time today. And please let everybody know who you are, what you do, and why.
Oh, gosh. Thank you, Michael. I it's my pleasure to be here. I've been really looking forward to this conversation for a while now. Who I am, what do I do? I started a company about 32 years ago, specializing in what I called at the time, common sense, toxin-free building materials. My background is architecture and commercial construction. And way back in 1992-ish, I remember working on a project in Milwaukee where we were supplying some water-based coatings for a below-grade parking structure. And after the primer coat got applied, we started getting phone calls from people living in the condos above complaining about the solvent aromas. And we thought, it's water-based, it's got to be safe. Well, soon thereafter, we actually had to rush three of our workers to the hospital because of ventilation complications. They couldn't breathe. The coatings, as they were curing, were literally sucking the oxygen out of the room. And so it stopped the job, went on a search, found a company in California, a small company called AFM, American Formulating and Manufacturing. And they made paints and coatings for people with chemical sensitivity, people with sick building syndrome. And again, early 90s, I didn't know what that was. Not many people did know what that was at the time, but it became my mission from that point on and to create a company that sells nothing but healthy, low tox or toxin-free building and remodeling materials. And because of the background that I have in architecture and commercial construction, it became very easy for me to work with architects, engineers, make sure they specified the right materials for projects. But, you know, they didn't want these materials for their projects. They would always say, well, we'll wait until we have a client who's interested in the environment, who's interested in eco-friendly. But yet after I get done with my presentations, people who worked there would come up to me privately and say, where can I buy this stuff for my house? You know, I remember specifically giving a presentation to a hospital in Milwaukee. And I had a nurse that came up to me after the presentation. She said, I heard you talking about paint. She said, I've got a daughter with autism and she can't be around any chemical emissions because it exacerbates her issues. Would this work? And of course, you know, because it doesn't off-gas, it was perfect. But then it just dawned on me, well, maybe I should not market and sell this to the commercial space because it's obvious that they're just not ready for it. I'm going to market this to homeowners, to the people who pay the bills, the people who will know the difference between what is safe and what is not safe. And that's where we started. And that's really how we continue today.
You know, it's interesting about what you said, you know, just in terms of not being ready for it and why homeowners are, because a homeowner, it's their space. Mm-hmm. They have to live there, right? So they're cognizant of that. It's important to have a healthy environment.
Right. The
commercial spaces are for other folks, right? And so you only do something commercially unless, you know, if other people are requesting or if other people want it. But also, I think we have a responsibility as professionals to educate people on why they might want it, right? And it sounds like you've done that and people are like, oh, I don't know, you know, but
yeah.
Thankfully where we are today, you know, it's a lot more prominent. I mean, you know, the White House just had a summit yesterday for 4 hours about indoor air quality and how, if we don't start battening down the hatches on indoor air quality, we're gone as a society. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it was the most remarkable thing that I've seen come out of the government on this topic in a really long time. And what's interesting is, you know, they were talking about how the Biden administration put about $8 billion for air quality. And now the Obama administration back in 2008 put about $8 billion towards appropriations for air quality. The Biden-Harris administration, just for comparison, put $122 billion on the table for air quality. So we see that the tide is shifting. I think COVID kind of opened up a lot of eyes here. So I think it's phenomenal about just that timing of being ready. We're now in a different world today than we were, you know, 30 years ago, and people are much more ready. And I'm sure you've probably seen that out there as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think that, you know, from a commercial standpoint, you know, I can see where they're coming from. Again, I used to be in that world. So, you know, if you have an architectural group that is hired by a building owner to design a structure, unless the building owner themselves said to them, and specifically, we want toxin-free interiors because of human health. If unless those words are said to the architect or the design team, they're not going to offer it because in their eyes, they think it increases cost, it decreases the aesthetic, increases the just the overall stress factor of the construction team. None of this is true, of course, but this is what they thought.
Right.
But yet, you know, to your point with homeowners, they're the ones paying the bill. They're the ones that have to literally live in this space. And they're the sort of the architect, the design team all in one. And if they're remodeling a room, it just makes sense. If you could choose between flooring materials and paints that are completely free of chemical off-gassing or the stuff you normally buy, if the price is about the same and the aesthetic is about the same, why wouldn't you choose the healthier option? And so, you know, it just makes sense that the homeowners would pick up on it right away. And, you know, I'm excited to hear that the government is starting to focus on this. Although, you know, my history in this industry goes back a long way. And so when I got started in the early 90s, you know, it was the mid 90s with the Clinton administration when we first started getting regulations on the books for things like VOCs. And now that turned into an absolute nightmare, which is actually causing the indoor air problems that we're having today. So what I hope this doesn't do is cause more future problems, because I think a lot of times with types of governmental regulations is they leave it so open for manufacturers to slip in and you know, get their special requests put in. You know, look at the VOC regulations themselves. You know, VOCs are only regulated because of outdoor air pollution. It has absolutely nothing to do with indoor air quality. Yes, it's true. Some VOCs are dangerous for humans. It's also true that some VOCs are completely harmless, but they were all regulated the same. And when they regulate the same, they also then gave manufacturers exemptions of about 37 different chemicals that they're allowed to use, that they're still technically volatile organic compounds, and they're highly dangerous solvents to humans, but they don't actually react with nitrogen and UV to create smog. Therefore, they're considered unregulated. And that's because of lobbying by large corporations and large interest groups. And so we have to take matters into our own hands like we did in the early 90s and say, let's not wait for somebody to tell us what to do. Let's just do what makes sense.
No, that's great. I think that's really great. And, you know, I've kind of been practicing the same approach. If I was waiting for the government, you know, I wouldn't exist right now and I wouldn't be pushing new standards and trying to increase, you know, just a different way of remediating and looking at that. So, no, I totally agree with you. And, you know, hopefully you're right that they don't leave things so wide open that the regulations don't really matter. Right. And I think that's really important. Certainly, I like to see the funding increase because that means that they're going to be making investments in our schools and our workplaces and things of that nature that help keep our kids safe. And you know, my only question to that whole thing is, who's measuring the results?
Bingo.
What metrics are they measuring by?
Yes.
Because obviously those things are really important. And my faith in that is very low just because I haven't really seen anything come out of I haven't really seen any technology in the testing world come out since the introduction of ERMI in 2015 by the EPA. Mm-hmm. We all know the pitfalls of that algorithm and scoring methodology, but the introduction of using MSQ-PCR technology to look at the environment was absolutely brilliant because now we're picking up stuff that is otherwise behind walls that we have no idea is there. So, you know, it's, how do we use that technology and advance the future? And I think, you know, that's something that I know that I've been trying to do. I know I've been helping people that way, but If you don't know how to use it, and if it's not widely used, then it's not, you know, it's only helping a right. small, very fractional amount of people. Right. I know we're getting into dangerous territory. Well, this will be an entire political discussion here, and I want to kind of zoom back into for sure. our listeners. It's always important to cover these types of things so people understand the brevity of the situation. But going back into just the building environment, first off, what you do is highly important and highly valuable. Because I think, you know, it matters what we put back in our homes. You know, many people listening to this podcast are looking for answers on mold. They, you know, they're ripping apart their houses because buildings were built improperly. You know, there's no ventilation. You know, definitely want to touch on how the direction we've gone since the 70s and how building tighter homes for energy efficiency is creating an impact. But let's just zoom out for 2 seconds. We have this whole ideology of, you know, something caused problems in our home that leads to mold, bacteria, you know, some of the things that we're using that can increase formaldehyde levels, VOCs, et cetera. Where is the foundation for all of that? You know, what are you seeing out in the field that is just, you know, something we've done in the past that just absolutely needs to stop that's causing a lot of issues that you see?
Wow. Boy, that's a great question, but it's also so broad. You know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, construction, and I work with clients all over the world, but let me just focus in here in Wisconsin right now, upper Midwest, okay. where it's, you know, 0 degrees with 15% humidity in the winter time, and it's 90 degrees with 60% humidity in the summertime. The way we build homes right now, especially here in the upper Midwest, it's essentially asking for mold problems down the road. And we got this way because of a couple of things. First of all, it always comes down to, you know, follow the money trail. And it's less expensive to build with wood than it is to build, you know, insulated concrete form, which is the preferred method to build to avoid mold in a house, in any home. The trades all know wood. So let me just use an example. The house that I'm working on right now, it's going to be a model house for us here in the area. We went back and forth with insulated concrete form or SIP panels, and we decided on traditional wood framing because that's the way 99% of homes are built these days. And we need to showcase what people can do simply and easily during the design and build process to make it better. So some of the things we need to focus on is we need to understand that during construction, weather happens and moisture happens. You know, we were just talking off air about the hurricane in Florida, and look how much, you know, water poured into homes during construction. What happens is the first sunny day that comes out, the contractors are back there now working on the home, and eventually a lot of that moisture gets locked into the cavity wall. So what could change? Well, number one, I think if construction was done on a, not necessarily on a timeline of when things get done, but on a more of a weather timeline of or a weather chart of, all right, well, we started out and the studs were at 20% moisture content. We're going to wait until they get down to about 14 before we actually start putting on any drywall or siding or anything like that. I think we need to use different criteria as a whole to decide when the next stage of construction would start, because we don't want to have moisture locked in the cavity wall. As you alluded to before, since the 70s, homes have been becoming tighter to eliminate energy use, to eliminate drafts, but walls are not built completely airtight. In my opinion, a home should be completely airtight. It should be built as just one monolithic box with no openings. We all know that's not going to happen. So we build those walls as tight as possible and introduce air where we want to and when we want to. But the reality is on job sites, things get missed. Flashing details get missed. Penetrations don't get done correctly. And then the biggest thing is moisture in the walls that eventually down the road could be 2 years, 4 years, what have you, will lead to a mold problem. So we need to take a keener eye on how these homes get put together, not worrying about how long it's taking, but worrying, making sure that it's the right time to do the next step.
Mm. Speaking through that, I mean, I've seen, I was building my own home at one point, no longer, let's just say that didn't work out as I had expected. In the midst of that, you know, as I'm driving through the neighborhood, you know, I'm seeing crazy things like, you know, the exterior is not even done and people are putting up drywall inside. I mean, we know how that story is going to go, right?
Yep.
The drainage pathways are, you know, not being fully done on the assembly. They're only putting drainage pathways on the wood frame, no drainage pathways below that. They're just stuck going right onto the cement, right. No waterproofing membrane, vapor barrier, nothing. The vapor barriers on the floor that are obviously supposed to help slow down diffusion into the concrete. Well, there are holes and gaping holes and stuff everywhere. I mean, it is a mess, right? Yes. And you see that house to house to house. We see lumber sitting in the soil. Structural Building Component Association, they're a great association. If you read some of their guidelines or recommendations, if you will, they don't recommend leaving lumber in the soil because there's mold and bacteria in the soil that transfer onto the wood. They recommend elevating it out, wrapping it, leaving both ends open for ventilation. When do you ever see that?
Never.
Never. Right. So we have, you know, we have really intelligent people that are putting together really intelligent plans for folks. Problem is that nobody's forced into following those plans.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
And you see people doing different things. I mean, even if we keep it out of the soil, we're going to build wood frame houses, wood semi-porous, going to lock in some moisture when it rains. Right. Mm-hmm. Don't you think it would be a great idea to maybe make sure the house is dry before we start introducing insulation and drywall?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it makes tons of sense, which is why you look at a construction timeline, you know, the contractor gives you a chart. All right, here's about every 2 weeks, this is what's going to be happening on site. I wouldn't do it based upon time. I would do it based upon when's the next logical step. Yeah. And you know, with weather the way it is, weather is unpredictable. So I can't tell you, Michael, how many jobs I've had where the home is under construction and then you got a week of rain and 10 inches of rain. And because the exterior, because the house isn't totally buttoned up yet, it's not dried in. You've got water in the basement or water in the crawl space. You've got, water all over the subfloor, and contractor gets back to site, squeezes off the water and just kind of continues along. Well, those houses are the ones that we then have to go in before any of the interior finishes start and literally spray down the entire house with a product like Calo-El to kill off mold spores on the wood and keep it from coming back. But in that process is also allowing ample time to dry. So we're putting in industrial fans, dehumidifiers, anything we can do to get rid of moisture out of the wood, because if that moisture is in the wood, once it starts getting, you put a building wrap on the outside, you put a drywall on the inside, or even a vapor retarder, which in some areas that's code, the moisture just sits there, and that will lead to a mold problem. Again, it may not be next week, but it might be in 4 or 5 years, but it will happen.
Yeah, it's like there's a reason we call it dried in.
Yes.
That's an important step.
It is.
Dried in doesn't just mean it's buttoned up. It means it's buttoned up and the wood is actually dried in, and then
correct,
it's ready for the next stage.
Correct.
And that dried in stage gets skipped on more often than not.
It does because the contractors will say, oh, don't worry, that'll dry out once the house is operational, all that moisture will come out. And my question is, well, if you did your job right and you air sealed all the gaps in the wood to wood connections on the exterior frame, and if you didn't use Tyvek, because that just causes more problems, if you use something like Zipwall, and then, you know, so if you did all those right and all the flashing details around the windows is correct, then there isn't a place for that moisture to go.
Right.
So I don't understand how they can say, don't worry, it'll dry out, because it's not going to.
Well, I had a builder tell me that I didn't have to worry about the mold because once they put up the drywall, it would essentially encapsulate the mold and then it would never affect me. And I thought that was just brilliant. Wow. Especially coming from someone to me. And as I looked at that, the guy was dead serious. And I said, well, how do you think people get sick then?
Right.
Yeah, the mold's behind the wall and right. somebody gets sick in front of the wall. How do you think that right. happens? Well, I don't know. I think that's just, those are just stories. No, these are real people that get sick. Like
yeah,
the mold is very small, sir. It's going to go through different interstitial cavities and it's going to make its way in. It's just really interesting. Kind of like I think the mindset of that industry for most of it, not all of it, obviously there's amazing people out there trying to do amazing work, but you know, from your standard home builder, I mean, they're just slapping stuff up and there's no real accountability to timing and different sure. stages of what they should be doing. And, you know, a brand new home could be a very moldy mess
yes.
the second you move in. And that's what we're seeing in some communities. And it's just absolutely heartbreaking.
And I'll say, even if you do everything right, you know, Mother Nature is what she is. And there still can be problems that are unexpected. Or I shouldn't say uninspected, that are that we don't want to have, but we are prepared for. I think of two jobs recently building healthy homes where our construction team did the absolute best they could, but you know, in the middle of a storm, which is, you know, we have these straight line winds, almost like tornadoes that come through here, knocks off downspouts and during a torrential rainfall, and then you end up getting water in the basement. That water in the basement, then, you know, that moisture evaporates up into the underside of the joists in the subfloor. You know, it under those right conditions, and it's certainly a hot summer like we had, that can lead to some mold activity.
Sure.
And so I think the key there, though, is that we had a construction team that was looking out for that, and they were able to nip that in the bud immediately. It's the situation where it's hidden and you can't see it, like you say, and the builder says, don't worry, that mold back there won't ever hurt you. You know, it's kind of an interesting segue, but you know, you and I have been working with a client mm-hmm. and, you know, in her situation, the home had been built for many years. Nobody saw a problem. Inspectors came through, didn't see any problems. But after being in the home for a couple of years, the whole family started developing serious health issues due to mold exposure. And it's because, to your point, the mold's in the wall. Not visible. It wasn't even active enough to show up on any of the tests that she did. But whatever was done during the construction of the home initially caused the problem all these years later. And so this is why builders will say, we don't have anybody complaining. Well, that's because, first of all, their warranty is typically 1 or 2 years on the house, right? After that, they're out of it. Number two, what's the average time people live in a home these days? 5-7 years before they move. That's about average. And so usually the mold problem occurs with the next owner or somewhere down the line far enough where the builder isn't even of an issue. And so we're finding problems with homes built mainly in the 80s and 90s, where these homes were built with some energy recommendations. And this is about the time where you started getting energy code written. You started having homes built tighter and tighter because of energy efficiency. You know, the whole green movement started in the 90s. And by the year 2005, homes are being built so tight. It finally took somebody to say, maybe we need to have fresh air for the occupants of the home. So how do we do that? Well, they started introducing heat exchange systems, right? Mm-hmm. You always hear this adage from the builders, well, a house needs to breathe. Actually, that's not true. The occupants of the house need to breathe. The house could care less. But if you build the home to allow the walls to breathe, but just ever so slightly, that's when you have those problems. So it takes a while sometimes for those problems to occur.
The house needs to dry. The people need to breathe. You know,
beautiful.
That's exactly. Really the key.
Yes.
if a wall is built tight and it leaks, it's going to be really difficult to fix, you know, and I think real costly to fix. I think that's one of the challenges presented. That's why water management and water mitigation is so important, because you know, look, the second you build a building, it starts to decay. You know, we have lots of natural laws of physics that are just moving and shifting things until something falls apart at some sort of seam and water will come in. Right. And we have to be prepared for that. Like you said, preparation is key. You know, we have to be prepared for that. And quite frankly, in some cases, we're not prepared for that. And that's when things start to happen and people start to get sick. Let's talk about Ashley a bit. You know, for those listening, if you haven't seen Ashley's story, she's on the Mold Heroes podcast. Check it out. Andy, tell us what you found in Ashley's home. What were some of the pitfalls there that you saw that was really the driving force behind these problems?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's still kind of peeling an onion. When you have a client or anybody who's living in a home that they buy the home, it's their dream house, and everything specs out to be perfect, and there's no visible sign of mold problems anywhere, no sign of water leakage. And then mysteriously, after living in the home for a couple of years, the entire family gets sick. You know, it makes you think about what happened in that home before they moved in. The previous owners, did they notice anything? Did they cover up anything? Did they repaint specifically to cover up maybe some water damage? I don't know. And I don't want to speculate, because I certainly don't want to point fingers. But I think it's also the perfect storm of situations. I mean, they're dealing with, you know, bathrooms that have either no vent or a vent that vents into the attic. You know, they're dealing with sheathing that is literally a food source for mold, insulation that was wicking moisture, and you know, so many other things. What I'm helping them do is I'm helping them rebuild with making recommendations that aren't going to A, cause any problems in the future with mold, and B, aren't going to exacerbate their health issues because of chemical exposure. And this gets really difficult, because a lot of times the best thing you can do for preventing mold may not be the best thing you can do for preventing exposure to chemical release.
True.
There's usually a give and a take. So a client comes to me, if a client like Ashley comes to me and says, we want to remodel this house, the first thing I ask is, when you say you want to do it healthy, what do you consider healthy? You know, is it from a mold exposure standpoint, EMF, building materials? If it's all the above, what's most important? Because sometimes we'll have to pick materials based upon the importance of how it can help the family. And so it's been a daily, weekly phone call with Ash and Sam, and talking about rebuilding things and materials to look for. For me, it's kind of a situation of, I think it was the perfect storm of a situation in a home that it just took a very long time for these mold issues to show themselves. And I know it's a brick exterior, so we probably had some moisture wicking from the brick into the sheathing. There probably wasn't an air gap. So you got a constant moisture source going into those cavity walls, and it just took a long time for it to really rear itself.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, you know, many homes that I go into and you see these problems, it's, you know, sometimes there's obvious building busts. Sometimes there's just the structure changed and moved and things started to come in, and not all the time they're visibly apparent. I mean, I walk into homes that are absolutely stunning. You would never guess there's anything going on there. And then you start doing some testing and you're like, wow, these levels are off the charts, right? This is crazy. So it can really be insidious and difficult. I think that's why it's so important to kind of utilize testing in today's technology, what we have, you know, based instead of just visual inspections, because it can be very misleading when you walk into homes and think like, ah, oh, this home looks great. It's clean. I don't see any issues. So,
right.
You know,
and I agree with you. Matter of fact, because most of the consulting I do is remote. You know, I'm based in Wisconsin. I work with customers all over the world. I rely quite a bit on test results. And even if the test results come back looking sort of average or sort of normal, at least it's some test results. At least it's data that we can use and then start checking things off the list of what could possibly be wrong. And so I'm a big believer in test results. Now, I'm also a big believer in saying that the test results you get are sort of at the hand of who's doing those tests
sure.
and who's interpreting them. I get a lot of folks asking if they can themselves maybe buy a VOC meter or buy a tri-field meter for EMFs or buy a formaldehyde meter. And I don't necessarily discourage it, but what I do say is if you don't understand how these things operate and what can cause spikes on the meters, then don't rely on the information that you get. Case in point, I have a client in St. Louis area who was doing some of the prism tests, the home air checks in his house, and the results came back and it's just spiked unbelievably high in VOCs. And so he's convinced that the thing he just did is causing a problem. Well, come to find out after probably 2 days of questioning, I find out from him that, well, he is a diabetic and he did take a cotton cloth, a little bit of alcohol and wash part of his skin and give himself an injection while the test was occurring, which spiked the VOCs because of the alcohol use. These things, these tests are very, very intricate. And so, you know, instead of spending thousands of dollars of ripping out the cabinets and putting in new cabinets because he's thinking that's what spiked the VOC meter, just said, well, maybe do the test again, but don't, you know, wipe alcohol on your leg. Problem went away.
Interesting.
So again, these test results are only as good as the tests being done themselves in a perfect environment by a professional who knows what to look out for to avoid having these inaccurate results.
Yeah, no, it's very important because obviously if you go through that and you're relying that on, you know, you're relying on that, that data, you want to make sure that data is accurate.
Correct.
Going back, so I want to touch on this a bit just to get off of mold, right? Because there's other air quality pollutants that occur in people's homes, lead, asbestos, VOCs, formaldehyde, you know, all the above, et cetera. You know, what are some other things that you commonly see that are problematic that are causing some health reactions for folks? And what are some of the things that you do to, you know, help them understand what those things may be and source different products for them? And before we wrap up too, I definitely want to touch in on some of the nothing's perfect. There's consequences for every action. You got to make sure you understand those consequences before kind of moving forward.
Right. So let's take new home construction just because it's easiest to talk about. And I think people can relate, whoever's going through remodeling can relate to this. 90% of the chemical off-gassing that will occur in building materials. And keep in mind that studies dating back 20 years have shown that new home construction, there's anywhere between 10 and 15,000 chemicals in the air just because of the building materials and the processes in the house. 90% of those building those toxic chemicals in the air come from the things you see and touch on a daily basis while living in the house. We spend an awful lot of time in consultations and I'm, you know, on podcasts talking about the construction of the home, the framing, the insulation, the air barriers, the caulking and sealants and windows, things of that nature. But truly 90% of the problem is from flooring, wall finishes, cabinetry, and millwork, and then your own personal furniture and window treatments and things of that nature. So what I would say is that last 10% from insulation, caulking, waterproofing, things like that, it's important to discuss, but ultimately it's not going to be the big things that'll affect the indoor air quality from a chemical standpoint in any new construction or remodeling. So I advise people to spend more time on choosing those materials, the interior materials, because that will make the biggest impact, positive impact. I personally focus on formaldehyde. I have been for 30 years now. Formaldehyde is a key trigger for allergies and asthma. Formaldehyde obviously is a carcinogen. Formaldehyde is not only a toxin, and it's not only an ingredient in materials, but it's also a byproduct of a lot of other things. It's a byproduct of flame retardants. It's a byproduct of pesticides. It comes off of anything from fabric treatments to cabinetry finishes. And so many years ago, we worked with a PhD out of Japan. He created what's called a formaldehyde release attenuation test, the FRAT test. And this FRAT test is essentially a small sensor that I can put on any surface of the home. And in 30 minutes, it'll tell the system will tell me down to one part per billion how much formaldehyde is coming off of that surface. I know that if I can reduce the formaldehyde off-gassing, I also know I'll reduce the off-gassing of many other chemicals that are petrochemical related or along the same lines of the same molecular weight. And so we focus on formaldehyde because that is a key trigger. I don't necessarily focus on VOCs because, again, VOCs are not always dangerous to humans. You know, you peel the skin off of an orange, you release 850 grams per liter of VOCs. It's not going to hurt you unless you have sensitivity to, you know, orange oil. On the flip side, if you use nail polish remover, which is acetone, and a lot of folks listening today can relate to what the smell of acetone is. If you use acetone in a gallon of paint, do you know that it's zero VOC? This is why most zero VOC paints on the market have either been enjoined in class action lawsuits or fined by the FTC for duping the public about their VOC content. The fact of the matter is that some VOCs are harmful to humans. Yes, VOCs are only regulated by the EPA because of outdoor air pollution, but the industry connected that dot years ago because they needed a way to sell these products. And now we all just assume if it's high in VOC, it's dangerous. If it's low in VOC, it's safe. Neither one of those statements are accurate.
Depends on the type of VOC.
It does. Yeah. It does. And so in carpeting, for instance, there's a lot of carpets out there that tout being zero VOC. Well, but they still use 111 trichloroethane. How can that be? Because trichloroethane is a volatile organic compound, except the EPA exempted that compound to allow the manufacturers to still use it. They exempted it because it doesn't actually rise to the upper atmosphere and create smog the way that other VOCs do. So they argued correctly, it doesn't actually contribute to outdoor air pollution. It does poison people, but the EPA doesn't care about that.
Makes sense. Well, I mean, it makes sense and it doesn't, of course, but
yes, of course,
makes sense for that argument.
Right.
You know, with respects to obviously VOCs, which obviously is a very complicated process in and of itself, because we've identified that not all the VOCs are harmful, and even at low VOC products are still using harmful chemicals that obviously do off-gas and do cause exposure to humans, which can cause some adverse health reactions. We touched on formaldehyde, which, you know, I think just for people listening to just understand the brevity of, like, when you're ordering furniture, baby furniture off of whatever website, and it's shipped to your house, you know, it is probably off the charts of levels of formaldehyde.
Correct.
How long does it take for formaldehyde to dissipate or get lower to where it's a little bit safer for those who are buying furniture? And maybe someone's like, crap, I just bought something and I can't choose an alternative option. You know, obviously ventilation would be good. Cleaning's great. What are some expectations of how long it'll take for that to dissipate?
Sure. So we know that based upon research done many years ago, that formaldehyde and other VOCs can release from painted surfaces, from the paint itself, anywhere from 2.5 to 4.5 years after it reaches a full cure. As this is any chemical emission, as a matter of fact, doesn't have to be formaldehyde or a VOC. Chemical emissions can occur for 2.5 to 4.5 years from a finish. From something like particle board or plywood, when you have a 1/2 inch or 3/4 inch of material, I've seen, and I've actually tested plywood subfloors that were 30 years old that are still off-gassing. I've tested carpeting that's 35 years old that still off-gasses toxic levels of formaldehyde.
Wow.
So it never really goes away. And in situations like carpeting, carpeting also becomes a sponge for anything else that's off-gassing. So, you know, these tests that I've done, there's no way to determine if that's just from the carpet itself or from everything else in the house that's also contributed to it. But that said, how do we avoid these things? Well, you know, you touched on something earlier that you touched on the topic of a metric, a specific metric, whether it's for mold or for pollutants, what have you. Right now, the only metric the industry uses for indoor air quality from a material standpoint is VOC. Even though I've just argued now for the last how long that it's irrelevant, this is the only metric the industry has. Things are changing. There's a third-party certification called GreenGuard Gold. GreenGuard Gold has certifications for things like cabinetry and flooring and some other home goods that say if it's GreenGuard Gold, it cannot exceed 7 parts per billion of formaldehyde off-gassing. That's the max. To me, if you can get materials below the 20 part per billion, I think it's relatively safe for the average homeowner. In the air, generally in the air, when you do air quality tests, 20 part per billion is considered the low level. Although, again, this is not a metric that is used extensively in the industry. This is what's used by maybe LEED. Some of the other organizations will use this. You want to get that below that 20 part per billion threshold. But, you know, if you're looking at something like OSHA regulations, that's 100 parts per billion in a 3-hour period. So, I mean, there's just such a wide range of what's considered safe. So the best thing we can do is let's get as low as possible. You know, and so if we know that if we can reduce the flooring off-gassing to nothing, if we can reduce the paint off-gassing to zero, the cabinetry, the countertops, these are the big things in the home. If we're reducing all of these things to, let's say, less than 7 parts per billion to meet the GreenGuard Gold certification, then in the air should be less than that. So I would say those are the things to look out for. Obviously, the bigger items, the things that more size and mass in the house are the ones you want to focus on first because they have the largest potential.
Right. And that's like, you know, kind of the same in the mold world, you know, in a moldy home, you know, when you're looking at crawl spaces and basements and attics, you know, high levels of mold in those areas are obviously going to impact the space a lot more than a little bit of mold in the corner of your shower. Right. So,
sure.
You know, it's always important to kind of look at the overall picture. How much can you reduce at right. one time is always the best bang for the buck in that regard. When we talked earlier about, you know, just there's always a consequence no matter what you do. Right. Yeah. You can use any material in the world. And if you understand the consequence of using that material, you'll be able to better surmise what to use it with or how to use it and all of those things. And I know we touched on that offline a little bit earlier, but I wanted to kind of harp on that because I think it's really important. Yep. You know, you can build a home out of almost anything as long as you know how to do it based upon what you're using. Right. And there is no perfect solution. And right. there's everything that you do with the intention of mitigating risk, but nothing is risk proof, right? So right. you mind touching on some of that just sure. so people can Because I think it's really, really important people go into this with the right expectation.
Sure. So I mentioned this before that if I were to build a home, let's say money was no object. If I were to build a home today, I would want to build insulated concrete form. That's the exterior framing where, if your listeners aren't familiar, you're essentially building all the exterior walls with these hollow, like Lego blocks. The inside and the outside of the block is 2 inches of a polystyrene insulation. The core is filled with concrete. And then when the concrete cures, those foam blocks remain, and that stays as your insulation. You put your siding on the outside, your drywall on the inside. When it's done, it looks like any other home. You wouldn't know the difference. But what it does do is it completely eliminates thermal bridging in the exterior frame of the house. This is where mold is most problematic. When you get, again, here in Wisconsin, you get in the middle of winter when it's 0 degrees outside and it's 70 degrees inside, thermal convection happens and all the warm air will travel to the upper outer reaches of the room. And then it usually then transfers through the drywall into a stud, because the stud, let's say if it's a 2x6 stud, that's an R value of 5.5. It meets with a cold temperature from the outside, and somewhere in the middle of that stud, you get ice crystals forming because of that thermal bridge. And so in the spring, those ice crystals melt, of course, and it turns into water inside of your cavity wall. Well, ICF eliminates that. There is no possibility of thermal bridging. However, it's 20% more expensive, right? Yeah. It's much more difficult to find a contractor who even wants to build with it. It's very difficult to find an architect who wants to draw for it. So there's a lot of things you have to go through. So that's the biggest con is going to be time and price. So I always have to tell customers, yeah, there's a better way to do things, but there will be downsides. And in this situation, it's price. So then we look at traditional forms of construction. You can do traditional forms of construction, which will be less expensive, easier, faster, so forth. The downsides, now you have to take these precautions that you wouldn't have to in an ICF wall. I want you to do things like a zip wall instead of using Tyvek. You know, I don't like having that building wrap flapping in the breeze that every seam, wind-driven rain gets through it, wind-driven snow gets through it. They're stapled on, causing small penetration, so on and so forth. A zip wall system eliminates that as a problem. Make sure that, you know, when you insulate, I don't like spray foam insulation because it off-gassed for many years and it's caused many customers of mine horrible, horrible health issues. But I like doing things like blown-in blanket system with standard fiberglass insulation. Just make sure you do air barrier, air seals, and all the wood-to-wood connections so you don't get those air gaps causing condensation. So again, there are things you can do, but then we want to make sure that we kind of think that all the way through so that we're covered and understand that sometimes you got to take a step backwards to take two steps forwards.
It's absolutely brilliant, Andy, and I really appreciate, you know, all of your insights here today, because obviously, you know, the building system's complex. There's like 50,000 different plus components inside of a home, with more coming every day. Yes. There's all these different types of products and solutions, and you know, it kind of leaves people confused as to what's the best. I mean, I get questions every single day. Should I use this system? Should I use that system? I mean, there's right. So many different systems to choose from.
Right.
People are constantly sending me new products to look at and research every day. And I can't keep up with it all. Yeah. You know, it's because my goal is to keep up with the science behind how do we mitigate and improve the environment, our homes? How do right. we look for these things? What do we have to do to lower our exposure? And that in and of itself is a daunting task. So I really appreciate what you do. Where can people find you if they need your services right now? Because I tell you, after they're done with me, they're going to need you.
I would say the best way to do it is to go to my website, which is thegreendesigncenter.com, T-H-E, greendesigncenter.com. On the front page, you'll find a big picture that says, you know, consulting. And from there, they can book time with me. I all my appointments are booked through that service because I do work all over the world. So I have different days, different time zones that I have to work. I work with people who just need me for 15 minutes because maybe they want to put in a new storm door or screen door, and they just need some help with choosing adhesives and caulking materials, all the way to working with customers during the design development phase of new home construction. And when I'm working with the architect, the engineer, interior designer, and everybody's collaborating on their part, my part is to look at what they're doing and say, well, I love what you're doing here, but this is the owner's intent is to have this home a healthy home. So we need to find replacements for these materials. And that's what I do. You know, one of the things I can say about being in this business now, being in the construction business since the late 80s, is that I've seen an awful lot and I've seen just about every scenario, but yet I still learn every day from every interaction I have with experts like you, with even my customers. They're teaching me things and telling me what I need to look out for. Most of my clients have already spent countless hours doing their, you know, research online, and then they're probably more confused because we all know what research is. It's basically going to Google, and the results you get are usually what manufacturers want you to know. The research I've done is 30,000 clients over the last 30 years plus, and I can tell you what worked for them and what didn't work. And so we've got all that anecdotal information to go along with the scientific test results. And we use that kind of in combination.
Yeah. More of the stuff the manufacturers might not want you to know.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Some of them like me, some of them not so much.
Yeah. Well, it comes with the territory because obviously their goal is to sell a product and your goal is to inform and educate and make sure people understand what those products really are and what they'll do and what their limitations are as well. Well, Andy, this has been really a pleasure and a blessing. I hope everybody found this conversation as informative as I know I have, and has gotten some good golden nuggets out of there. And one more time, tell people where to find you.
All right. TheGreenDesignCenter.com. I also have a podcast, Non-Toxic Environments, three words. You can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Andy. It was a pleasure. And I know I will be in touch with you very soon.
Thank you, Michael. Really appreciate it.